Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. If you're enjoying this show and you'd like to support it, go to everyonelovesguitar.com/support. And for information on advertising, visit everyonelovesguitar.com/advertise. Hey, everybody, this is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. And today we got one of my musical heroes on. We're going to show some love to the rhythm section. Simon Kirk, this guy keeps time like a Swiss watch, and I'm really happy. It's an honor and a privilege to have him on the show. Real quick, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe to subscribe to the show. Excuse me. If you're watching us on YouTube, hit the subscribe button with the little emoji that looks like a bell, and that helps YouTube recommend us, and thanks for your support. Real quick on Simon, obviously most well known for being the drummer and a founding member of two of the greatest blues rock bands in music history, Free and Bad Company. Over 5 years, Free released 6 studio and 1 live record and sold more than 20 million albums and played more than 700 concerts. Man, when you finish 700 concerts, I bet you feel like there's nothing you can't do musically.
Well, I think, you know, I would have liked, number one, it's nice to be on your show. Thank you for having me. And I wish Free could have gone on longer. Mm. But as most people know, most people of our age know, yeah, it was Free just kind of sputtered to a halt. We had two and a half very, very good years. But I guess we'll get to that in the interview.
Yeah, yeah.
I do wish Free could have continued.
Yeah, so do I. I love every one of those records, man. When Free broke up in 73, Simon and Paul Rodgers formed Bad Company along with Boz Burrell on bass and Mick Ralphs on guitar. They were actually the first band signed to Led Zeppelin's Swan Song Records. Bad Company released 12 studio albums and a half a dozen live albums. 4 records went gold and 4 went multi-platinum. Simon's also played with some amazing musicians, including, of course, Paul Kossoff and Mick Ralphs, brilliant guitar players in Free and Bad Company. He's also recorded or toured with Ringo Starr's All-Star Band, Mick Jones from Foreigner, Ron Wood, John Lord, of course, from Deep Purple, Jim Capaldi from Traffic, John Wetton from Asia, Freddie Scott, a plop, soul artists from England, Van Morrison, Frank Black, and others. And Simon himself is a multi-instrumentalist and has released 3 solo albums of his own. He's originally from London. He lives in Long Island now. He's also a governor on the board of NARAS, which is the Grammy Award Committee. And he's also on the board of directors of a charitable organization called Road Recovery, which helps at-risk children deal with addiction. Man, thank you so much for coming on this show. I'm so stoked. Like, I feel like a little kid when I talk to one of my own musical heroes. So I thank you. It's good to feel like a little kid once in a while.
Yeah, it is. I haven't heard my my history, you know, like condensed like that. I'm kind of surprised that. But you know, there was a lot of, I played with a lot of other people that you know maybe weren't aware of. You know?
Yeah, let's talk. Tell me.
I don't know who Freddie Scott is. I don't know how that got in there, but and I never played with Van.
Okay, that's all music's fault.
That's okay. Wilson Pickett. I did an album with Wilson. That was great. Keith Richards. I'd have to really think long and hard about all the people I played with: Ray Charles, Bo Diddley,
holy
Chuck
shit,
Berry, Fats Domino. Yeah,
that's incredible. All right, I got a million questions, so let's get into this. You're 18 when you formed Free.
19, actually.
19.
What were 1968, yeah. I was born in 49, so I was just 19.
That's amazing, man. To come up with music that powerful at that age, says a lot about you guys as a team. That's not normal, almost, and I mean that in a good way.
Well, I still maintain to this day that Free were, you know, and I'm not going to include myself in it, but when you've got one of the best singers ever, one of the greatest guitarists ever, and one of the best bass players, you know, and these were all, I guess you could call them child prodigies, because Andy Fraser was only 16 or 15 when we met him. And Koss was a year younger than me, and he was a superb guitarist.
Incredible.
Say about Paul Rodgers. So from the get-go, you know, we had a leg up on I guess, the competition. We were very young, and we were very, very good. And just out of the gate from our first rehearsal, we knew that this was going to be really good, a good band.
Oh, you had that feeling early on?
From the first, actually, you know, from the very, very first rehearsal, when we, I don't even remember the first song we played. It was so long ago, but there was a kind of, we were almost like heads down, like, fucking hell, this is, ooh, man, this is really special. And by the end of the rehearsal, maybe 6 or 7 o'clock in the evening, we were a band.
I mean, holy shit.
No question.
That's awesome. What were the biggest challenges of getting things going early on?
You know what? There really weren't a lot of challenges back then. We were all semi-pro in that we were doing manual jobs. I don't think Kossoff was. I think Koss was, you know, a fully fledged pro, even though he was only 18. It was, in a way, Craig, it was a lot more simple back then. You know, you rehearsed, you got in a van and you went to shows. And I remember after about the second rehearsal, when we got in a name, Andy Fraser sat in his little house and wrote out 200 letters. And he mailed them to all these various clubs all over England before the internet, you know.
Yeah, like real letters, real stamps, licking envelopes and shit, yeah.
I mean, there weren't really many challenges other than getting your act together, writing original songs, and that's the key, original songs, and then going out and playing them. That really, we weren't married. None of us were married. There were no kids or, you know, wives' responsibilities, which, you know, as we all know in life, when they come along, your strength in a way gets kind of dissipated and spread around. I don't mean that in a denigratory way. That's what happens.
Oh, that's the way it is.
But it tends to shift the focus away from the band. So that didn't apply to us back then. You know, we were really hell bent on becoming a success and taking it to the next level.
That's actually almost cute to hear that you wrote 200 letters and mailed them. That's like a great story. Like nowadays, you know, people are too lazy to send 200 emails, but you guys sat there manually and cranking that out. That's a very cool story.
Yeah. I've never mentioned that before, but yeah, we were really driven to be as good as we could. And then we'd have, and I don't know if other bands have ever done this, we'd have listening nights. And Andy had a very good little system. He had I don't know how I remember this, and yet I don't remember what I had for lunch.
That's all right.
He had a Leak amplifier, Wharfdale speakers, and a really nice turntable. And every Monday night, we would go around to his house and bring an album that we thought the others would like.
Oh, man.
Sometimes we play, well, Otis Redding was a done deal, anything to do with soul and blues. But we bring Mozart. I brought Mozart once and Bach. We'd listen to all types of music. And the four of us would be in Andy's bedroom just absorbing, you know, something that, you know, Koss liked or Paul Rodgers liked. And that really was a kind of a bonding experience that really helped cement us, you know, mentally.
Yeah.
Music. Yeah.
And it's very focused. You know, when you have that kind of direct focus, when your intention is that deliberate, you tend to have a better end product, you know?
Yeah.
That's great, man.
And the Beatles, I mean, of course, we listened to a lot of Beatles because we all loved, I love Ringo's playing. I love Paul's bass playing. You know, they were just such a superb band. And back in those days, the stereo was very primitive. You could actually pan to the right and hear Ringo and John with rhythm and then pan to the left and you're hearing Paul and George. It was almost like you could isolate the tracks and listen to what each one was doing. So, well, I remember those sessions, those listening sessions with a lot of fondness.
That's so cool, man. Is it true? I read that Tons of Sobs, which is your first Free record, which if anybody doesn't know that record, if you're into blues rock, you got to listen to it. It's freaking phenomenal. Was made on a budget of 800 pounds.
Is that? Yeah, I'm sure about it, right? Well, look, 800 quid back then was probably worth about 5,000 now. But even so, it was still, you know, peanuts. Because basically, Craig, what we did, we played our club set with Paul had written a couple of songs, Over the Green Hills, Walking My Shadow, and Sweet Tooth, I think, yeah. But the rest of the 7 or 8 tracks were basically what we just did on stage. So I think the recording only took 3 or 4 days. And then, you know, mixing was maybe a day. So, yeah, 800 pounds sounds about right.
That's a good value. It's the best value you ever got, I bet.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it didn't sell very well. I mean, we were just brand new. But we got our foot in the door, and it still stands up to this day, particularly Paul's singing and Koss's playing. And I'll say Paul because Paul Rogers and Koss, Paul Kossoff, because we had 2 Pauls. So Koss was really he kind of shone on that album. And people were like, whoa, who are these guys? You know, are they from America? No, we were all from London.
I remember I bought that record down, you know, they don't have many more, you know, one in the village in the used record bins like many, many, many years ago. And I was like, holy shit, this was amazing. I think it's a great record. I don't know why it didn't sell more. Who makes a first album like that?
I don't know.
I mean, that's, you know, pretty damn good, man.
And the thing about it, you know, was the other great story about it is when we shot the cover. Because we had this loony, great, but mad producer, Guy Stevens, who was employed by Island Records to come and produce our first album. And he'd been to the club to see us. And he just said, just play your set because your club set is so good. But then he came up with this idea. Number one, he came up with the title, Tons of Salt. And then we had to go and shoot the cover in this graveyard. And we had to get up really, really early. And we were like hungover or, you know, 9 o'clock in the morning. Come on, man. So we got to get the light right. And apparently he hadn't gotten a permit to shoot in this graveyard. So we had to do everything quick before, you know, officials saw the lights and the flashes and asked what was going on. And sure enough, just as we were leaving, you know, a police car pulled up and we sort of scooted out of there. But, yeah, we shot it in a graveyard and then Mickey Mouse in a glass coffin and, you know.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah.
You had a bunch of cool covers. You had one cover, you know, let me pull it up right here. The next album, Free, that was such a cool cover, looking up.
Best cover of them all. Ron Raphael. Great guy. He just passed away a couple of years ago. And it was the best cover, I think, or one of the best covers in my career.
Yeah.
Because the next one after Fire and Water was pretty awful. But let's get back to Free because he was great. He was such a nice guy. He came to the hotel. We were in L.A. And he just wanted to shoot us individually rather than the four of us, which was a change. Because when you're all together, you're not quite yourself because you're with other people. So he came to each of our hotel rooms and shot each of us. He had a little Leica, a Leica rangefinder, and he used natural light. And the four individual shots on the back cover are so lovely. And we're natural and he's talking to us. And then inside, it was a gatefold, you had this girl, I believe she was his girlfriend, and she was jumping across actually in his studio from one bed to another. She was leaping. She was a dancer. And he had her leap across one bed to another while he lay under her. It was a lovely job. he shot her. And it was just a really cool cover.
Yeah.
Ron Raffelli.
That's a great cover, man.
Yeah.
1970, you're 21. and Free is playing the Isle of Wight Festival with 600,000 people, man. What the hell was that like?
That was, I'll never forget that. Well, you know, All Right Now is climbing the charts. I believe it was about as high as it would get, which was number two. We never got to number one because of Mungo Jerry.
In the summertime?
Summertime. But we were put on Saturday night of the three nights, which was the big night. The Who, Sly and the Family Stone, et cetera, et cetera. So we were very, we were nervous, and we got to the gig early. We flew by helicopter from this little island, Isle of Wight. And we were put in one of the little caravans, you know, at the back of the stage. There were about a dozen caravans where groups would get ready to go on. And we got there, I think we were supposed to go on about 7 in the evening, Saturday night. I mean, it was a big spot. But, you know, it was so disorganized that we kept being pushed back another hour and then another hour. And we'd have a little drink and a little smoke or something. And you know, by 10 o'clock, when the guy said, oh, sorry, man, you know, we're delayed again, our manager, Chris Blackwell, said, they're not going on tonight. Forget it, you know, because it was such chaos. And he did a very smart thing. And, of course, we were disappointed because we've been, you know, looking forward to going on for hours. And he said, no. You're going to go on tomorrow morning. You're going to be one of the first bands on in the morning. Very smart. Because it was chaos. I believe Sly didn't take to the stage till 2 in the morning.
Holy crap.
You know, and everyone was wiped out. And so when we came back, I believe we went on about 11:30 or noon. Sunday morning. It was a beautiful morning, and we hit the stage, and it was a great gig. I mean, I was still terrified, but it really put the stamp on our arrival, if you wish.
Yeah,
it got us in a lot of periodicals and magazines all over the world. Paul was on the front of the Sunday Telegraph magazine, you know. So it was a great gig, and I'll never forget it.
What was the difference between, like, when you guys finally came over here and toured? Is there a difference between the fans, how they react in a concert setting with you here versus back in England in that time period?
That's a great question. I never thought of that before. Well, inherently, the Americans and English, there is a slight difference. I think the Americans are a lot more demonstrative.
Right.
If they like you, you know, they'll, you know, they know how to have a good time, the Americans.
Right.
Look at any Super Bowl halftime show, you know, that's.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, you would know about that, wouldn't you? A couple of weeks ago. Well, Buccaneers, congratulations.
Yeah, man, thanks.
I saw Brady trying to throw the Heisman Trophy over the water. God, someone caught it, you know.
He's a big hero here now, man.
Anyway, you know, the English are a little bit more reserved. That's just how we are.
Yeah.
And it took Free a lot of goes around England, you know, before we built up a fan base. And we built up a very solid fan base, and particularly in the north, the northeast of England. We really, you know, whenever we played there, we went down a storm. But America was pretty much from the get-go. They liked us. And when we came back again, they loved us.
Yeah.
You know, we had a great time the first couple of tours of America. And it was great for us because my influences were American.
Right.
The Black Dick Stax, Motown. Blues, you know, and it was a kind of a trade-off. You know, you'd have Herman's Hermits come over here, Dave Clark Five, you know, the Mersey scene,
yeah,
huge over here, and yet in England we had the blues and we had, you know, Wilson and Aretha, Otis Redding, Rachel,
yeah,
so, James Brown. It was a nice trade-off.
You know? Yeah,
but I would say that touring America. Was a huge thing for us because it was such a vast country. And I say this again, and I've said it before and I say it again. you can fit England into Lake Superior.
Yeah, right.
It'll actually go into Lake Superior with no problem. Just England, not Scotland, Wales, and but England with 50 million people
right.
would disappear into Lake Superior. That's how small the country is. So when we started touring America, it was like, what, 600-mile drive?
Wow. right. Right.
Worth it. It was worth it.
Did it take an adjustment for you to get used to, like, as I told you, my wife's English, and I'll never forget when I, when the first time I went to her mom's house, like 93.
Where's she from?
She's from Dunstable, which is like 30 miles northwest of London. It's like near Luton, not far from Luton.
Yeah, in Hertfordshire. Yeah, Bedfordshire.
In Bedfordshire. Yeah. They used to have a big, the Dunstable Cali was like a big concert thing there. But I went to England, and this is the funniest thing, man. This is like a typical American versus England thing. She put out a plate of salmon salad, right? Mm-hmm. And I started eating it, and everybody around the table's looking at me. And I thought, I'm like the new puppy, right? Like, what did I do wrong?
The American, yeah.
Yeah, that was for everybody.
The same thing, brother. Don't worry. Yeah.
Did it take you a while to get, because there is a, you know, we do tend to be more boisterous than the Brits, especially back then, comparatively.
No, I took to it straight away.
Okay.
And the women, I mean, we attracted a lot of ladies.
Oh, I'm sure.
I love the thing about the American women was that they love sports.
Yes.
They knew baseball and RBIs and touchdowns and football and shit. And they, you know, you go to a game and half the audience would be women. And you just didn't have that in England back in the
60s. Really?
No, it was great. And they were so much more independent here. They had money. They drove. They buy you shit, you know, because we're struggling musicians.
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly in New York, we were very well taken care of by the ladies.
Right on, man. Right on.
Believe it that, you know.
Just, yeah.
You know, we had a ball.
Just one more question about Free. For the amount of work you did, it was kind of a wild ride. Like it seemed like it was nonstop. And the fact that you were so young, and then when Free dropped, Bad Company came really quick after that. It didn't seem like you got any time to decompress between the two.
Well, yes and no. I mean, look, in terms of chronology, there was only a few months between the demise of Free in the fall of 73 and the start of Bad Company in the spring of 74. But you got to remember, you know, when you're 24 years old, 3 months is like 3 years.
Okay, gotcha.
You know, it's not like, oh, I'm in 71 and 3 months is like a week. But back then.
I know that's the truth, ain't it?
You know what I mean? And I couldn't wait to start a new venture because, quite honestly, the last 12 or 18 months of Free had been a nightmare,
yeah.
A real tough slog. And I got back from my little touring. I went down to Brazil and stayed there for a few months. And I got back late 73, and I called Paul Rodgers up because we'd always gotten on, you know. And I said, hey, man, you know, how are you doing? What are you up to? He said, oh, I've met this great guy, this guitarist with Mott the Hoople. And we've been writing songs together and we're thinking of forming a band. And would you like to play drums? And I said, I'd love to. I mean, if you look at it coldly on a piece of paper, it looks like there really wasn't much time, but yeah, there was. Then that company just took off.
Is that the same thing with it was like instant? There really wasn't any challenges with Bad Company?
Pretty much because, you know, me and Paul had come from Free. Mick had come from Mott the Hoople, and he'd left under duress. He wasn't having fun. Him and Ian weren't getting on. And, of course, me and Paul Rodgers had been having our troubles with costs and the whole Free thing. So when we formed forces, joined forces with Mick. We had to find a bass player. It was like a new lease on life. You know, we were just so happy to play. And Mick was a great player. He wasn't the genius, but he was a wonderful player. And he wrote great songs. And
definitely.
He was funny. I love him to this day. He's my brother. And, you know, it's a tragedy what happened to him with the stroke. And now he, you know, he's just out of the game now. But back then, he was just so much fun to be around. And then when we'd been writing songs and rehearsing, still looking for a bass player, and Paul Rodgers said, you know, we need a good manager. And who's the biggest band in the world? Because that's how Paul thought. Led Zeppelin. All right, let's call him up. And we had a connection in our road crew. They were two New Zealanders, two guys from New Zealand. One worked for Zeppelin, one worked for Free, and they knew each other. They were like brothers. And we got, Paul Rodgers got Peter Grant's phone number. And typical Paul, he just called him up and said, hey, we've got a band together. And Peter Grant said, I know. What? And we found out that Peter Grant knew everything about everyone. He was amazing. So pretty much out of the box, you know, it was a perfect storm colliding. And once we got Boz Burrell on bass, we just took off.
And you guys had each done – it wasn't like starting a brand new business, because you'd each done the legwork in your former band. Sure. So that you had the wind under your sails already, I would imagine.
Very good. Yeah, it's good analogy. We had a fan base. People were fed up with Free, but they still loved us.
Right.
You know, they were tired of reading about Koss's overdoses and another cancelled tour, but they still loved us.
Yeah.
And to this day, there's a lot of affection for Free in England. Same with Mott the Hooper. Mott were that they loved Mott. So when they heard that, you know, me and Paul and Mick had joined forces, and we were with Swan Song, who had tied with Led Zeppelin. My God. And we just took off in 1974, big time.
I give Paul a lot of credit for doing that. It's not – Peter Grant's a pretty intimidating character to just pick up the phone and call. No, you need a good set of balls to do that, man. You know, you have to be
– You know, it was a touch of fate, because Zeppelin had just formed Swan Song, and they didn't have any bands.
Right.
Zeppelin, of course, but they wanted other bands on the label. So when we came along, and I'll tell you a quick story about Peter Grant, how smart he is. He said he'd come and see us rehearse, and we didn't have Boz at the time. We were still looking for the bass player. We had a stand-in guy, and we were playing in this little village hall in Surrey. And Peter Grant lived in Sussex, which was a long way across England to come to us. He said he'd come and see us rehearse. So we were all, oh, my God, Peter Grant's coming. So we were in this little village hall. It was in the summer, late spring. We were playing, kept looking out in the car park. No Peter, because no cell phones back then. And then about 2 hours after he's supposed to come, he walks in. We go, oh, hey. So we come off the stage and shake hands, blah, blah. First time I'd met him, and he was a big guy, you know, like 300 pounds. And he said, oh, sorry I'm late, boys. Sorry, traffic. And he said, okay, we'll sit down and we'll play the set. He said, don't worry, I've heard it. And we go, what? He said, well, I parked the car around the back of the hall, and I saw the windows were open, and I've been listening to you play all afternoon. I've been out in the car park for 2 hours.
That's so smart.
You'd be a little nervous, so I just listened to what I hear. And by the way, I think you're fucking great.
That's so cool.
Yeah, and I thought, what? And then he said to me, can I carry your cymbals to the van? And I go, what? That day on, I loved him.
In the documentary, you spoke very highly of him. Mm. And I was surprised, because, there's not a lot of good press about Peter Grant. And that was actually a very loving thing he kind of did with you guys.
Well, there was. And I don't want to tarnish, but I have to tell the truth that you know, he died about 25 years ago. And we found out that he'd done, him and our lawyer had done a little bit of shenanigans in terms of royalties. And I don't want to step out of line because I don't want to get sued by the family. But he had taken quite a large percentage, a lot. I don't know the exact figure. In perpetuity.
In perpetuity? So, that's forever.
He would have a cut for a long, long time. So it kind of tarnished my memory of him. But you know, to his credit, he looked after us very well while we were together. And we were together about 6 years before it all imploded, exploded, whatever you want to say, when Bonzo died and Zeppelin broke up. And, you know, he was a great manager, no question.
Yeah. I've talked to so many people that have had stories like that. It's almost like it was to be expected back in the day that you'd be getting screwed somehow.
He was old time. He was the old time manager. He had underworld connections. He knew people, let's say. He maybe two or three steps removed from the English underworld. He was old school management, which was, look, if you don't fucking do what I say, someone could get hurt.
Yeah, maybe.
The new breed arrived with their diplomas and law school degrees and so on, and cell phones. Mm. You know, he was the last of the old school managers, and it worked.
Yeah.
He never interfered in our material. He never, and I remember Robert Plant saying, don't worry, Peter will never tell you what to play or what not to play. His little creed was on stage, wear something bright and jump up and down a bit.
That was it. Wear something bright.
And jump. He told Robert and Paul, just wear something bright and jump up and down a bit.
Interesting.
Yeah.
What would you say the top three experiences that you had in the studio?
Oh, all right now, for sure.
You knew it was magic after you made it.
That's imprinted in my brain forever. Because it was such a great song to play. And I think we took it, we did takes of it up to about 20 or 22 takes with full starts and stops and whatever. And I believe we took maybe, we used number four take. But it wasn't just the actual playing of it, because it's quite easy to play. It's really, it's a satisfying song to play for a drummer. But Paul's guitar, Kosse's guitar, when he did the solo, I'll never forget that, because he levitated. And then after, when we got it in the can, and we said, play it again, play it back again. It's like 2 a.m. We go and play it again. And it's so, oh my God, it was wonderful. So there's that. And I guess the first album of Bad Company was a lot of fun to play because we could hear, for the first time, we could hear ourselves on tape. We'd never record, you know, nowadays with the iPhone and iTalk, and you can record on this and that, little four-track recorder, there was none of that. We never heard Bad Company until we got in the studio. And I believe the first song we did was Can't Get Enough. And you can hear me count it off. One, two, three, go brat.
Yeah.
And we heard that back for the first time. Went, wow, pretty good, man. So I would say that. And wow, it's hard. I know. Wilson Pickett would be my number three, because I've always loved his singing, and I got to play on five or six tracks of his album. And I'll never forget, we were rehearsing and he's singing and he just stopped. He stops. He said, whoa, stop. And I'm going, oh shit, did I do something? He said, let's take this motherfucker. It sounds so good.
That's awesome, man.
That was, yeah, those are my three.
Was Kosse's solo worked out, or was that on the fly improvised? If you know.
I would say it was worked out, because it was such a a landscape that he had to navigate.
Yeah.
You know, he started off low in the mid in A, down by the fifth fret. And as you know, it's a famous solo. He ends up right above the 12th fret.
Yeah.
So he kind of worked his way up. And we had played this song quite a few times at sound checks and shows. So it wasn't like we went in cold and did all right now.
Okay.
So, yeah, I think it was worked out. And he kind of stuck to that solo throughout his career. It was just so beautifully worked out.
It's a pretty perfect song in general, man.
It's one of the greatest guitar solos.
Yeah.
And to this day, I think he should have gotten a writing credit. That's my own personal opinion.
Yeah.
Because it made the song.
It was fantastic, man.
Yeah.
How about live? What's your top three experiences playing live?
Well, the Isle of Wight, for sure. And then when Free was at its peak, and whenever we go to the Northeast, which is Newcastle, Middlesbrough, or Sunderland, we get the shivers because we knew there was just something about the crowds up there. And there was a place in Newcastle called the Mayfair Ballroom. Oh, my God. And whenever we played there, I remember once seeing the whole balcony moving up and down. People were jumping, you know, there were 1,000 kids up there. And it wasn't a very big place, maybe 1,500. But so I would say the Isle of Wight, Bad Company's first show at Madison Square Gardens.
What was that like?
That was, oh, man, we'd arrived. This is the garden, man. You kidding? And then as a little asterisk, and the Mayfair Ballroom in UK. But then as a little asterisk, I would say the first show Free ever did in the old Madison Square Garden, which was about 12 blocks south of where it is now. And we were on the bill with Blind Faith and Bonnie and Delaney.
God,
and we
were
and I've never been in a hall so big in my life. So that was a scary piece of we only played 30 minutes, but yeah.
What a show.
Yeah.
Did you grow up? I read two things. I read that you from London, but I read you grew up in the countryside.
Yeah. I was born in London, but I was raised on the border of Wales in a very remote part of England called Shropshire. The county was Shropshire.
Yeah.
We had a house that had no electricity or running water for about 4 years.
Holy shit.
Yeah, and then we moved to what's known as a council house.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in Clun, which is about 4 miles from that little house. And then we had electricity and running water, and we got our first TV. And that's when I saw this program called All That Jazz, which featured big bands. And that's when I got the lightning bolt to play drums because I was watching this drummer.
Who was it? Do you remember?
I believe it was the Jack Parnell Orchestra, a big band, and the drummer, I don't know his name, but it just got me. Something about that guy playing. And it was that great swing, almost like rock and roll. In fact, you know, big band swing was the father. If you combine that with rockabilly, it was the father to rock and roll. It had the same... And I was off and running.
Man, so you have a really good success story, man. You grew up with no running water, moved to a council house, and shit. That's a great fucking story, man. A council house here is like, people don't know what council houses here. A council house there is like a government, right? It's a government supported house.
Like tenement, but not really. There was no graffiti or anything.
That's only in New York. The rest of the world country, I don't think has that. No, my wife lived in a council house when she was a kid. I know exactly what it was, man. That's a great fucking story, man.
Look, Craig, it was a great leap up from where we've been.
Yeah.
I remember my mom was so happy because she had a cooker that worked. You know, she didn't have to use, we had this thing in, you know, like she'd have to put firewood under, you know, light fire to cook. We had baths in a tub that hung on the wall.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just a wonderful step up. And then I was lucky because I had something to pull me through that. And I read about boxers, you know, from the Latin American countries It's their way of getting out of the ghetto, you know, and something like a northern star that pulls them through. And that was what music was to me. I didn't want to grow up in the country. I was a city kid. You either were a farmer or you went in the army, and that was it. And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be a musician, and it really, it helped me just get out of that area.
Were your parents supportive of your music ambitions?
My mom was, God bless her. She was. My dad was not very happy because this was in the days before the Beatles. No one made money out of being in a group. You know, it was a hobby.
Yeah.
You know, it was a release a bit of, you know, piss and vinegar. You
yeah.
know, get let off some steam. But no one, and I wanted to leave the family and go to London and you know. But so my dad was not happy. And so we arrived at a compromise. And it's kind of a famous story that they gave me 2 years.
Yeah.
And if nothing happens after 2 years of me being in London, then I would go to college and I had some good grades. And I wanted to be a photographer, a war photographer. I wanted to go and shoot war scenes.
But
I wanted to be a journalist, photographic
yeah.
journalist. That's what I wanted to be. And then I had 2 years. And then on the last month of those 2 years, I got a break and I met Paul Kossoff. But, you know, that drawbridge was coming down.
Yeah. Where did – so, as you know, it's not normal to – you had a lot of drive. And when you typically grow up in that sort of environment, most people don't, primarily because they're looking around and it's not a lot of optimism, right? Why do you think you had that drive? Where did that come from? Or what did you – I know you said music was your North Star, but there's got to be something underneath that pushing you – to leave your.
I don't think anyone has ever asked me that before. That's a great question. And I would say, off the top of my head, that I really loved playing. I really, really loved playing. And I could see myself doing this at a higher level. You know, I started off with little books and tins on my bed. And then I got a little kit, went to that level. Then I played with this guy for about 2 years who had a stack of 45s and a couple of turntables. We went all over the Tri-County area with me playing drums next to this guy playing his records. So that got me to another level. And every level that I entered, Craig, I felt comfortable. And I thought, you know, I could do this. I really can do this. And then it was that leap of faith, going down to London, saying goodbye to my family at 18 and answering auditions and being turned down. I got turned down quite a lot. And then, you know, you're swimming with the big fish. You're looking at people. I'm going to the Marquee every chance I can. The Marquee is that famous blues club in London, and I'm seeing drummers like Ainsley Dunbar and Ginger Baker and Keith Moon, and I'm thinking, God, these guys are so damn good. You know, can I measure up? So I think that's the drive, was to prove people wrong.
Righteous indignation. I always say that, man. Righteous indignation has been a fucking savior in my life, man, to be honest with you.
Never thought of that, but that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. Yeah, because that's interesting. You're seeing Keith Moon and Ginger Baker. God, that's got to be tough. Okay. All righty. What were some of the low points or dark periods that you've had to deal with, and how'd you get through them?
Well, most people know that I've been in rehab several times, and particularly after Free. I think the first time that Free broke up was a really tough time. I wasn't into drinking or drugs back then, although I was extremely upset when Paul Rodgers and Andy Fraser decided to pull the plug. And Koss really took it badly. And I lived with him, and I saw him go down. And that was a really tough time for me. But I think fast forward several years, when Bad Company broke up for the first time, you know, after Paul Rodgers left the band, I really got heavily into drink and coke, and very bad. And I've been, you know, battling those. I was battling those demons for about 20 years, and I've been sober, you know, quite a few years now. But yeah, I mean, there were some times where I was a real, real mess. And, you know, thanks to the 12-step program, you know, and I work with this road recovery, which helps kids with all sorts of problems. So, yeah, but there were many, many instances where I was not fit to play. Actually, let me edit that. There were many, many instances where I was lucky to be alive.
Wow.
Yeah, lucky to, I got through it.
Can I ask you a couple of questions about your sobriety?
About what?
About sobriety?
Sure.
Okay. And if any of them are uncomfortable, just please don't answer. Just tell me no, skip it. What was the, like, I don't want to use the word rock bottom, that's kind of overused, but what was the trigger for you that said, I got to fucking stop?
Well, I nearly died one night. And I mean, I remember it very well now. At the time, but I was on a tour bus. We pulled into Nashville, and I'd gotten hold of some Ativan, and I was took a couple of them with some Jack Daniels. And I had a lady friend at the time. I wasn't married. I had a lady friend at the time.
That's like the for anybody, for any of his ex-wives listening.
Yeah, I didn't want to, you know, say I was being adulterous. And she got me. She saw that I was in distress, and she pulled me out of my bunk and got me to walk up and down, got me into the hotel, and kept, you know, sort of slapping me and walking me around because I was that close to dying. And had she not been there, I think I would have died that night.
Holy crap!
I'm sure I would, because all the others were out of it. They'd gone. We were at the hotel, and they just wanted to get into their beds. So they left me in the bunk, and I'm sure that would have been it for me.
Wow. When you look back at things like this, do you chalk that up to like a higher power watching over you, or serendipity, or how do you look at that? And how did you look at it back then?
Well, that was a wake-up call for me, and I checked myself in pretty soon after that. I don't know, Craig. Yeah, I'm a believer in a higher power for sure.
Yeah.
Whether it's God, whether it's Buddha, whether it's Vishnu, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Something's out there. And I say the Serenity Prayer when I can, and it really does help me.
Yeah.
It wasn't my time. And yeah, you know, I look at the, I look at the opiate problem that's ravaging this country as if we don't have enough problems.
Right.
You know, I see kids dying of this fentanyl, and they haven't even reached 20.
I know.
You know, and it's just, it's a sad, sad state. And it's really not worth it. I know it's easy to say it's not worth it, man. It's not. But, you know, for that high, which, you know, an opiate high is fucking high, man. It's,
yeah.
It's amazing. It's not for me to say it's lovely or it's not, but it comes with such a price that it can just take you like that, like falling asleep in the snow. You just drift away and you never come back. And I think that's the lure of it. It's not a way of dying that is violent. You just go to sleep and you never wake up. And the difference between a pinch of fentanyl and a line of fentanyl is the difference between life and death.
Wow.
Because I read up about it. Anyway,
get back. Wow. Thank you, man. I appreciate you answering that. I was interesting. Tell me one or two things that you did which at the time might have been out of your comfort zone, but hindsight 2020, they turned into good breakthroughs for you in one way or another.
Ooh. I'm not one for being out of my comfort zone. I guess riding my Harley from San Francisco to New York.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's something I've always wanted to do, but actually thinking about doing it, I've always wanted to do it, and I did it, and it was great. But there were nights when I was freezing my ass off, and I thought, don't fall asleep, don't hit a bad bend, don't, whatever you do, don't go to sleep. So there were a couple of nights where I was like, oh, shit, and here I am in the middle of Oklahoma or wherever it was. And then, listen to this, you'll like this. So I got to Colorado, I left San Francisco, and it was the end of a tour, and I always took my bike on the trucks. And I said, I'm riding this fucker home to New York. And they went, oh, God, please. So I get to Colorado, and we get to the highest point of the Rockies before it goes into Kansas. And my front brake snaps, the cable.
Oh, right on the high point.
I swear to God, like 10,090 feet. And I hit the front brake, and I'm just about to start the descent into Denver, and there's nothing. Oh my God! So I pull over and I look, and I see the cable flapping, and I'm not. I can't do that shit. That's not me. So I have to nurse the bike using the back brake and the gears all the way down into Denver, about 60 miles. And guess who's in town? The Stones. They're playing at Mile High. So I get hold of Ronnie. Ronnie's one of my dear friends. And he says, where are you, you fucker? I'm in the lobby of your hotel. He says, well, come up. So I, you know, parted with Ronnie and Keith all night while my bike is getting repaired in the local Harley dealership.
Holy
shit. A couple of crazy nights with them. And I finally make it back to New York. So that was one of my comfort zones. I guess that's about it, really.
That's a pretty cool story, man. Yeah, that's really cool.
Still got the bike. It's in the garage behind me.
There you go.
Yeah.
Tell me favorite musicians you've enjoyed playing with, because I know there's been dozens.
Oh, God. I would have to say playing with Ronnie. I love Ronnie Wood and Keith. I'm actually played with the Stones at a sound check when Charlie was late, and I played drums with them. Then we did Harlem Shuffle.
Oh man, that is so cool!
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Chuck Berry, I did a gig with Chuck at a private party. Their drummer couldn't make it, and I happened to be in Switzerland. It was a private party in Switzerland, and they called me in the hotel. Some friends of mine said, "You got to help us out." And playing with Chuck was a trip.
I've spoke to a lot of guys. He said he was kind of an asshole.
But when he was on fire, and we did 1 hour, 60 minutes, did all the hits, and to play with him, he was really inspirational, I have to say. Wilson Pickett. I mean, I got to play songs with Wilson Pickett, man. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And
How'd you get that gig?
Well, a friend of mine is a very good record producer called John Tivin, okay. And he lives in Nashville now. This is just before 9/11.
Okay.
And he called me out of the blue and said, hey, you want to play on an album with Wilson Pickett? I said, give me the address. And so John Tivin, a very good producer, now lives in Nashville. And I would say that was probably one of the highlights, playing with Wilson.
Very cool, man.
And Zeppelin. I did a gig in Munich. I was with Zeppelin because they were friends of mine, you know. And Bonzo said, hey, you want to play on Whole Lotta Love? It's just one night at dinner. Would you like to come up on Munich when we go to Munich? I said, fuck yeah, man. I'd love to. He said, all right, come round to my hotel tomorrow night. And I thought we were going to meet, me and John, and then go to a studio where there'd be two drum kits.
Right.
So, yeah. No, no. He said, come up to my room, and he had twin beds, and he sat on one bed, and I sat on the other. We're facing each other, and he starts off, and then he said, now, after about 2 minutes, I stop, bom, bom, bom. Then you come in, and we rehearsed the song in beds.
So how was it, you guys were huge. But then you're playing in a Zeppelin. Was there a, like, how was it? Was it a different vibe? Or was, I mean, they were like the gods of rock and roll concerts, you know?
Actually, in on that final tour, and little did I know that would be the last time
right.
I get all emotional talking about Bonzo because I loved him so much. I didn't know that would be the last time I would ever see him.
Because, holy shit, yeah.
Yeah, the next year he died, or later that year he died, 1980. My point is that Zeppelin's final tour was not the big bombastic lasers and dry ice that America was used to seeing, okay. You know, because they had the most wonderful light show, et cetera, et cetera. This was really stripped down. And they were playing arenas, you know, like the Garden or you know, the Spectrum. But they weren't giant arenas. They were like 8,000 or 10,000. And I believe Munich was about only 10,000 people. Only, I say,
yeah.
compared with what they were used to. So when they brought on the second kit, I could actually see the back of the hall. It wasn't like a big deal. And Bonzo was so, he said, wait for me, wait for my cue. It was a lot of fun. And I believe you can see it on YouTube. You can see it. It didn't have the quality that you can get nowadays with an iPhone.
Sure.
It was a lot of fun, man. I'll never forget it.
Simon, tell me your top three Desert Island Discs.
Well, the first one that really springs to mind is Hey Joe, because the first time I ever heard Hendrix. And I know I'll go back and think, oh, God. But no, top of my head, Hey Joe, that beautiful solo, Mitch Mitchell's drumming. Oh.
Yeah.
Wilson Pickett, Hey Jude.
Yeah, with Dwayne Allman. Was that with Dwayne Allman on?
I don't know. I know it was the Muscle Shoals guys. Yeah. So it was Dwayne.
I think Dwayne was on the, played on that. In fact, I think he was the one who convinced Wilson to do that song. Yeah.
And anything by Otis. Probably Rock Me Baby by Otis Redding. Oh, and Al Jackson. Oh, and a drummer. So, yeah, top of my head, those are my top three.
How long have you been in New York? Is that the only place you lived in the States?
25 years.
Oh, okay. So you've been there a long time.
Came over in 95.
What's your favorite New York City food? That's the only cheesy question I'm going to ask you. Sorry.
Well, my favorite restaurant is a place called the Waverly Inn.
Oh, yeah, I know what that is.
So there's no specific
dish. It's like a diner there, right? Yeah.
Say again?
Isn't it like a nice, cool diner on Waverly Place? Yeah.
On Waverly Street, yeah. So anything that the Waverly Inn wants to cook me, I'll eat. They're wonderful food.
Man, have you gone to I think they closed it, but it used to be not far from there, A Salt and Battery?
Yeah. Yeah. Some chip.
Yeah. Every time we go, Anne would stop. They'd fry everything there, like Oreos and shit. Like,
yeah, they'll fry it. Yeah. Yeah.
Tell me, in addition to getting sober, Simon, tell me one or two things that you might have done or one or two changes you made that have had a big impact on your life. Any way you'd like, business, musically, professionally, spiritually, anything that was important to you at the time.
Oh, well, I'm so boring. I would say giving up red meat. I mean, I'm sort of 90% vegetarian, and I know that sounds big deal. You know, I haven't joined any cults or anything.
There's still time. You got plenty of time.
I go to online meetings, AA meetings and things. Yeah. I'm a grandfather now four times over.
Hmm.
So, you know, that's really, I'm thank God I'm close to my kids.
Yeah.
You hear a lot of things in meetings and how people are estranged and life's too short. You know?
Yeah, man.
So you got to stick with your family. So, yeah, that's about it, I would think.
What makes you happy?
Oh, well, I do love playing golf. I mean, that sounds, They asked Billy Joel once, what was a day in the life of a rock star? And he said, an AA meeting and a round of golf. That's pretty close to what... I thought that was a great answer.
That is a great answer.
I love playing golf. I don't play it very well, but I do love playing. I like a sunny day on my bike, on my Harley. Writing. I love writing songs. I play guitar and piano. My drums are next door. And I got a lovely wife. I mean, I remarried several years ago, and I've got a very good relationship with my wife. So I'm a happy camper.
Good, man. Deserve it. What do you like most about yourself?
I try to be honest. You know, for many years I was dishonest, and I try to be honest. I'm glad that I'm sober, and I'm happy that I can play guitar and piano. Because drums, I love drums, don't get me wrong, but, you know, it's kind of, eh. I'm able to, I scored my first movie last year, a little independent movie.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What movie?
I could do that all day.
What movie?
It's called Sunset Boulevard, not the famous one by Billy Wilder. It's Sunset BLVD, and I think you can YouTube it or Google it. I think it's coming out this spring.
Very cool. You did the whole score on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's awesome, man.
Loved it.
Most important thing your dad taught you?
Ooh. He was a Christian, you know, not a devout Christian, but he was a Christian. And he taught me to be kind to my fellow man. And it's true. And if I see a guy on the street and I'll give him a dollar or, you know, try and help people out almost to a fault. When I went to India years ago, there were so many beggars out there. I just got a sheaf of rupees, you know, and my guide was saying, please don't. I couldn't help it. You know, I just had to give out. And 10 rupees is like a dime.
Yeah.
So it was no big deal for me, but I try and be kind to my fellow man. You know, I'm hearing about all the trouble down in Texas with the freezing temperatures, and you know, my heart goes out to those people because they have electricity to heat themselves.
Oh, I know. It's on top of COVID and all this other bullshit. Oh. We just needed this, right? I know. It's terrible, man.
Yeah.
How about your mom? Most important thing she taught you?
Oh, I love my mom. She had a great love of music. She died about 10 years ago.
Sorry.
And she had a love, yeah. But she was 90. She had a good innings.
Yeah, she good innings.
Love of music. That's where I got my and I only found out later that she played really good piano.
Really?
No idea.
She never told you that or tinkled around? Really?
Well, we didn't have a piano in our house, so she never brought it up.
Wow.
But I got my love of music from her. Yeah.
Any hobbies or interests outside of music and golf?
No. I love writing. I mean, I like writing and reading. I'm a voracious.
Yeah, you reader. Seem so well. I mean, you can tell somebody's, so, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but you could tell someone's, by their how they speak, that they're a voracious reader. I knew that you were, you could just tell when someone's.
I do love reading, and it's helped me a lot, particularly on the road, you know, all those hours on the tour bus. I have a little guitar with me. I have a little baby Taylor, baby Martin that goes with me everywhere. So yeah, I'm always playing.
Very cool. What's your favorite place you traveled?
Ooh, several. India and Brazil. Top of my head, you know, knee jerk reaction.
Yeah.
Some terrible poverty in India, but there's some most beautiful. The people were lovely, and some of the scenery is just gorgeous. Rio, once again, a dark side and a light side. The rhythm, the drummers, the people, the love of football, soccer. There's such a vibrant race. But you travel half a mile in the wrong direction, you get into the favelas and the slums, you could be in big trouble.
Yeah.
Overall, Rio and some of the Indian cities, beautiful.
A lot of people I've spoke to have talked about sort of like that dichotomy of India, that they love it, but the poverty really left a very deep impression on them.
Yeah. I'll never forget some of the things I saw. And it's such a vast country, and it's baking right now with the climate change. Central India and the South are just going through heat. You know, there was one month they were in above 110 every day, and they just don't have the air conditioning that we have in Vegas or, you know, the Sunbelt cities or where you live. And though it never gets really that hot in Florida because you've got the sea to cool it all off. But in India, man, they suffer in the summer.
Yeah. The thing here is the humidity is the worst. It's really bad. Just a couple more questions, man. And thank you so much. This has been like really cool. I appreciate your time. Funniest thing that happened, that's happened to you on stage or in the studio?
Oh, I got a couple of stories. I would say that one of the funniest things that happened was when me and Boz were fishing out of our hotel window. I thought that would get your attention. There's a famous hotel called the Edgewater Inn in Seattle, and you can actually rent rods and fish. And we were sitting there smoking a spliff, oblivious to the time. And Boz caught a little 6-foot shark. I mean, not little.
A six-foot shark. Holy crap.
And he's bringing it, and the rod is like. So he gets into the into our hotel room, and he's flapping around on the carpet. And it's snapping. And suddenly the phone rings. And it's our tour manager saying, "Where the fuck are you guys? We've got to get to the airport." I'm going, "Oh, shit." So we couldn't lift it up and chuck it back. We ran a bath and we put it in the bath, just the right length. We pulled the shower curtain and we got the hell out of there. So we get to Portland on the next, you know, the next gig, about a 1-hour flight from Seattle. We get to the hotel and Clive, our tour manager, goes in to check us in. He comes out 10 minutes later saying, "You've arseholes, you idiots." I said, "What? What?" He's looking at me and Buzz. He said, "This hotel is in the same company as the Edgewater Inn in Seattle. The maid went into your room, you arseholes. She's hoovering, she's cleaning the bath. She whips back the shower curtain and this fucking shark like flapping. She falls over. She's got concussion. She's going to take us to court, and we're no longer allowed in any of the hotels on this chain."
Holy.
We laughed about it then, but I think we had to give her some money, poor girl.
Wow.
They had security, had to come and get the shark and chuck it out the window.
Holy shit. That is like probably one of the best stories I've heard, actually, man. You picked a good one. Good answer, man. Two more questions. Biggest change in your personality, Simon, over the last 10 years, and how much of that change has been intentional and how much is a natural part of aging?
Well, being in the program, and most people who are in the program know what I mean when I say that, you take it a day at a time. And what with COVID and the previous administration of this country, it's been a rough, you know, a rough few years. And particularly now, here we are in the middle. We don't know when we're going back out on the road. So I would say my patience has improved since I got sober. I like myself a lot more than I did when I was using.
That's great.
That's carried over to my personal relationships with my wife and my kids and so on. I still get angry. You know, I still shout at the TV. Not so much now that Trump's gone. Because there's a lot of shouting, and I don't want to get political because I don't want to upset people, but I'm just glad that we have a new crew working on this country.
Right.
So I would just say that, yeah, I'm a lot more serene than I used to be when I was using, and I don't cough and I don't sweat like I used to. Thank God for that.
Yeah, man. Thank God for that. And last question, most important lesson that life has taught you.
You get out of life what you put into it.
Man, what a great way to close this interview. Thank you for everything, man. This has been such a joy for me. I really appreciate it. Like I said, you've been one of my musical heroes since I started listening to music, and it's a honor and a privilege to come and hang out with you for a little bit. And I'm so happy that your life has turned around, and you do seem genuinely happy, man, and I hope that carries forward forever.
Thank you, Craig.
Anybody wants to check out Simon, his website is Official Simon Kirk. It's K-I-R-K-E. I remember the first time I looked at the back of an album cover and I saw your name and I said, wow, that sounds so British. I don't know why I remember that. It's like, you know, a little kid growing up in New York, it was like a, you know, it's a foreign thing. You know, a guy in the-
is Scottish for church.
Oh, okay.
And my ancestry is Scottish and English. But the Kirk in Scotland is the church, and we added an E on the end for some reason. But so my roots are Scotland, Scottish and Ireland, and German apparently. I did one of those swabs, you know, the DNA.
Oh, yeah.
I found out part of me is German. So,
do you watch BritBox?
Say again.
Do you watch BritBox TV?
I don't. It's funny you should say that because people are saying, you've got to see the BritBox. Yeah,
dude,
I mean,
get it.
Look, I got Netflix and Hulu and HBO and Showtime. And there's a lot of English shows on there.
BritBox is cool. They have, because my wife, you know, she turned me on to all these. There's some really good, like, crime. I don't know. It's just cool. And I always love to see, again, as a guy growing up in the Bronx, if I see vast stretches of countryside and it's just beautiful to me to see. Of course, the sun is never out, but you know, it's so, and we're watching something now in Wales and it's just really cool, man. I was sick a while back and I was watching so much BritBox. I was really sick. And I woke up one day because I was sleeping a lot and I was hearing, everything in with English accents. That's how much TV I watch. And I never watched that much TV, but check out Simon, Official Simon Kirk. Once COVID's over, is there plans on touring?
Absolutely.
Great.
In fact, I was talking with, I was emailing with Mick Fleetwood from Fleetwood Mac a couple of weeks ago. And he said, what are we going to do when we get the green light? You got about 50 major bands dying to go out and play.
Yeah.
And I said, let's do a package tour.
Yeah, there you go, man.
In the 60s. Let's look like Aerosmith, Bad Company, Fleetwood Mac, and U2. How about that?
Oh, yeah.
Charge them $100 each, and we'll split the money. It'll never happen, but it's just a nice idea.
It is a nice idea, man. Well, I hope you come down to Tampa, because I'd love to come see you. And also, check out Simon on Facebook, on his official page there. Man, any final words of wisdom?
No, just, you know, look after each other. We're all we have. And let's please put your hands up for climate change.
Yeah, man, I hear you on that.
We've got to do it, man, for our kids and grandkids. And I just got to say, I saw this great hat, and I thought it was a MAGA hat. And the guy was like, he was kind of like a liberal. And I went up close just to see it. And he said, that got your attention. Black Lives Matter.
That's funny, man. Well, hang on a second. I'll wrap up with you. And thank you for everything, man. I really appreciate all your time. And thank you for being so genuine and sharing all the cool stuff about your life, man. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this, please share it on your social media channels. Thanks very much to Simon Kirk for fucking lifetime of amazing music and for his patience and kindness that he shared with us today. And most important, especially nowadays, man, remember that happiness is a choice. So choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar or your drums, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I am out. Simon, thank you so much, brother.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.